Stick a fork in Engine X. European DCs are stuffed. Aviz adds AI. Lockbit gets locked out. And we take a closer look at Operation Dying Ember in this episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Rundown. It is February 21st. I am very pleased to be joining you on this Wednesday afternoon. Joining me is one of my favorite co-hosts, Mr. Max Mortiaro. Max, welcome to the show.
Hello again, Tom.
It's a pleasure to have you, and I hope you're enjoying something as sweet and treatful because it is National Sticky Bun Day. But we have a lot of security-focused stories for this episode of the Rundown, so I hope you guys are appropriately password protected and using two-factor everywhere, because otherwise you never know what might happen. So Max, I'll let you go ahead and jump in with the first story.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom, and pleased to be here. So Nginx is the latest software platform to see itself getting forked in a dispute with the community. The issue arises from the publication of CVEs related to the Quick protocol. One of the community developers, Maxim Donin, said that the actions taken by F5 interfere with the longstanding security policy, and so he felt the need to fork the project into free Nginx. Both sides maintain that they are in the rights and also maintain the rights of the other sides to do what they're doing. So Tom, what do we do with that news?
Well, this was one of those things that the more you pull on it, just like a sticky bun, the stickier it gets and the worse you have to deal with all the things that are going on. So the short version, if you want to go like the history, is that Nginx was developed in Russia, and then it was sold to F5. And shortly after it was sold to F5, the people who sold it were raided by the Russian government, because a Russian company claimed that the people who developed Nginx actually worked for them, and they own the IP, and they didn't get paid, and messy. Well, then Nginx stopped doing business in Russia a couple years ago because, a thing happened. And so there's been this back and forth. And technically, the person who forked the project kind of worked for F5, but didn't really work for F5, because when they stopped doing business in Russia, the company that had been doing the business as F5 was a different company. And just go to the link that we linked in the article description and read it, because it's crazy. So basically, now we get to present, which is F5 decided to disclose some vulnerabilities in the Quick protocol, which is used by Nginx in a lot of their deployments, but it's not turned on by default. And so Maxim said, well, this was going to get fixed anyway, and I don't think you should make it into a CVE, and this kind of destroys what we've been doing with security anyway, so I'm just going to fork the project. And everyone is saying, you can do that. That's great. Now you have to maintain it. And that's the ultimate problem that I think a lot of people have with open source projects. Yes, the same freedom that allows the community to just fork the project and rebuild it from scratch is also the same thing that prevents people from coming to an understanding about the way to fix these problems. When it's a closed source program, you really don't have the option to say, I'm going to take my toys and go home. That has value in certain cases, but it also means that you go to, quote unquote, the nuclear option pretty quick. I'm glad that he's able to do this. I'm glad that he feels that he can maintain this code and that he has community members that are willing to help him. I also don't think F5 is going to sweat this very much, because on the whole, would you rather a company choose to disclose vulnerabilities, or would you say that they shouldn't disclose vulnerabilities, even if they're in adjacent protocols, because, oh, well, we'll get around to fixing that sooner or later? Because remember, the community roasted Juniper and roasted Avanti for doing the exact same thing just a month ago. We're not going to disclose these vulnerabilities. We're going to try to roll them all into one instead of making separate disclosures. You can't have it both ways. Either companies should disclose everything, or they shouldn't disclose it if it's going to get fixed anyway. Me personally, I tend to err on the side of disclosing everything, and if that's what happens, then the chips fall wherever they fall. Now, I don't know what the uptake on FreeGenX is going to be like. This could be like any one of a number of projects that just kind of die out, or it could be Open Tofu, which everybody takes off running. Which, by the way, I still think they should have called that Ferritorm, and that's the hill that I'm going to die on. All right, Max, we have a new report coming out from experts that say that data centers in Europe are in very high demand. The report states that hyperscalers are grabbing space in those data centers as quickly as it becomes available, while rental rates for those data center footprints has skyrocketed. Part of the reasons for that divide come from a lack of land area to build new facilities, as well as inadequate power resources to power those new facilities, as well as to expand the old ones. Now, if you were curious about what the primary data center markets in Europe are, that would be Frankfurt, London, Amsterdam, Paris, and Dublin, which I believe they've referred to as FLAPT. I think somebody came up with that acronym. And those seem to be the ones that are in the most demand. The secondary markets, which would basically be every other major area that has a data center, is actually managing to just keep up with the demand by adding, you know, certain megawatts of space. But the big ones seem to be like really in demand. But Max, you're from Europe and you do a lot of business over there. Is it surprising that they're having trouble keeping up with demand?
I would say no. And there are multiple reasons for that. I think you mentioned it already in the description. The issue is that there's not enough available land to, first of all, to do that. And the other problem is the energy, right? So, I mean, there are so many angles to look at that. You know, you even if you're able to find some suitable land, you need to be able to provide enough energy to that area to be able to get something viable. And the issue is that the grids, and especially across those large areas, are pretty much saturated. We can talk around other problems as well, which are impacting our economies in the EU, is that the fact that we're going through an energy crisis for the past 2 years at least, with very high prices and in some cases even not enough supply, especially countries which made some decisions ages ago to shift to renewables, talking about Germany, for example, countries which have been decommissioning nuclear plants, for good or bad. So that's impacting the ability to provide a stable grid, especially for power-hungry data centers, and especially in those large, you know, areas such as, you know, cities like London, Paris, Frankfurt, and the world Ruhr in general. So, I mean, the question is, what do we do with that? There's a regulation which is in place, which is coming up from the European Commission. Companies are data centers are going to have to start reporting on energy efficiency. And the law is the initial reporting is due to start around May 2024, and the whole set of rules is going into effect around 2025. So that is going to probably put some, let's say, pressure into those large data centers to start optimizing and maybe reducing or optimizing the load around energy usage. But for what you said, if there's that much real estate, there's nothing you can really do other than start thinking about deploying you call that secondary locations across the rest of Europe. And with that, we are moving for one story for you, Tom. So AVs Networks Gen AI, the startup AVs Networks is in the news with the latest version of their software that includes Gen AI. The new offering is called Network Copilot, and it adds overlay AI capability to the Sonic support that AVs was founded to provide. Network Copilot is based on the Mistral 7B LLM with over 7 billion parameters. Data is collected from the network and normalized before the LLM is trained on historical data to allow for natural language queries as well as help with creating deployment templates. So LLMs, Gen AI, and networking sounds like a crazy combination to me. So can you tell me more about that, Tom?
Yeah, I love the fact that it seems that every company is kind of arriving at the same answer for what's going on. Now, if you want to rewind the clock maybe 2 or 3 years, we had a lot of companies that came out that said, your network has tons of data that we have never been able to access. You know, anyone who's still using SNMP would probably agree with you. So we are unlocking all of that data. Well, the problem is that when you do that and you create your data lake, you forgot to add your life jacket, your life preserver. And so we just kind of toss you in the deep end. You're like, hope you can swim. And that's for people like me who understand how networking operates and know what to look for. For the rest of the world, including Max and a lot of other folks, I don't know what to do. And everyone kind of arrived at the same solution to this problem around the same time, which is going all the way back to something near and dear to my heart, which is Star Trek. Do the engineers in Star Trek fiddle with consoles trying to do stuff, or do they ask the computer to give them an answer? Most of the time, they're asking the computer, right? That's what this Gen AI overlay from Aviz Networks does, is it trains itself on a bunch of historical data that's pulled from your environment. And then it provides a natural language query portal for non-networking users to be able to ask questions. Where is the slowdown in my network? Why am I seeing packet loss? Those kinds of things. And it will surface that data, it will tell you what's going on, and it will give you opportunities to fix it. Like, where is the slowdown in my network? Oh, well, it's right here. It seems to be that this interface is underutilized. Can you create a template to fix the problem? Yes, here it is. And you can use that template in the future to prevent this from being a misconfiguration anywhere. That's easy, right? So instead of asking your friendly neighborhood network engineer to do that, you can ask an AI to do it. Now, you're probably still going to want to have your friendly neighborhood network engineer look over that template to make sure that there's no weirdness going on. But it speaks volumes to the way that we are starting to leverage these tools. We have the institutional knowledge to do this. We know what capabilities are. And if we can feed those capabilities to some kind of a software construct, we don't have to spend a lot of time, you know, futzing with the settings and stuff like that. Now note, I'm gonna put on my other hat here for a minute. This does not mean that you can fire all your network staff, because they're still gonna be needed to fix problems that AI doesn't know how to handle. It hasn't been trained on. This is just a way to give your network team more time to fix the hard problems instead of having to stop every 10 minutes and explain, well, where exactly is it running slow or things like that. And I love the fact that in the article that we linked, they interviewed the head of Aviz Networks, and he basically said, this is like the third LLM that we've been on. We started with OpenAI. We realized that wasn't going to work for us. Then we moved to some other ones. And I think that a lot of people are starting to realize that maybe OpenAI isn't the best solution for every one of their problems. ChatGPT is amazing, but it is not the end-all be-all of algorithms. You know, there's a lot of things out there that maybe do a better job for statistics, or maybe do a better job for providing technical data. Despite what you may think by, you know, like OpenAI trying to trademark the name GPT. Like, you know, that doesn't mean that they're the only game in town. So I would say, you know, props to Aviz for hearing about this and running with it. I'm sure that we're actually going to hear a little bit about this next week when Aviz Networks presents at Networking Field Day. And I can't wait to hear more about that. But also, I'm curious to see kind of how this works as we move forward in the future to, you know, leverage these tools and maybe make things a little bit better overall. All right, Max, I want to talk about ransomware for a minute. You may have heard of the name Lockbit. It tends to pop up several times, especially when we talk about ransomware. Well, thanks to an international effort that's been codenamed Operation Kronos, Lockbit has apparently been locked out of their own website, because there's a message up there now that says that it's under the control of the National Crime Agency of the UK in concert with FBI and Europol. Lockbit has not publicly commented, but if you know where to look for the things that they post in their encrypted Telegram channels, they maintain that they have offline backups that were not seized by the feds, and it's only a matter of time before they make a comeback. So, Max, is Lockbit gone for good, or are we just seeing a pause in their activities?
Excellent question. So, what is interesting and what always fascinated me with those ransomware criminal groups is how they are, to some extent, able to kind of operationalize and industrialize some of their activities, even thinking about sometimes building resilient architectures, which some companies could be almost envying, you know, in terms of doing things, having backup servers, etc. Not everybody has put the thought into that. Now, of course, for the victims and for the sake of the well-being, we can hope that operations are terminated. But I would say that if you go and put that much effort to build such a large-scale crime operation and go to not only just perform ransomware attacks, but build a kind of ransomware as a service approach, you would think that these people have a pretty good idea of what it takes to build those servers, etc. And so, in my view, it's just a matter of time before they rebuild something, if they're not caught, of course, and start running something, even maybe improving their resiliency. Because just like we learned from our lessons, you know, when something goes wrong, I would expect that those people are doing pretty much the same. After all, I mean, they're in the business of technology, and it requires quite some bit of engineering to build these kind of operations, no matter how legal they are. So I think that we're going to see those people back up to something again. It may take some time, but I don't think that it's the end of LogBit as we know it for now. After all, they talked about shutting down around 22 servers, something. It looks like quite a modest scale in my view. So then we can move to our closer look story for the day. The US Department of Justice is at it again with a new team for Operation Dying Ember. Sounds spooky, right? This time it was to undertake a secret court order to remove malware from Ubiquiti devices infected by Fancy Beer. The devices in question had default administration passwords, as well as remote admin access on the public internet. The DOG reinfected the routers with the original malware used to compromise them in the first place, and then used that compromise to remove remote access and clear up the secondary payloads that had been installed to turn them into a potential botnet. The DOG said it would then notify users to do a factory reset and install the last firmware, as well as changing their admin passwords. So there's quite a lot to unpack here, Tom.
Yeah. So, okay, it goes without saying, friends. Change the default password of your device and disable remote administration capabilities before you connect it to the internet. Okay? That being said, what I found fascinating about this story is that the U.S. Department of Justice obtained a secret court order to go disable these things on behalf of people. So just so we're clear, according to sources in the Department of Justice, the Fancy Bear group is run by ex-GRU hackers. Some of them are ex, some of them are current. And so what would happen is that they would hire out other people to drop MUBIT on a router to get access to it. And then GRU folks would go behind them and use the MUBIT payload to gain access to the router and turn it into a botnet. So what the DOJ did was, aha, cut by your own knife. We're going to use MUBIT to take control of the router again. We're going to kick all of you out. We're going to reset all the passwords and disable login from the internet. And then we're going to email the users and go, hey, you need to fix your problem. In theory, as someone who would like the internet to be a better place, bravo to you. Love that idea. Let's clean this thing up. Now I'm going to take off that hat and I'm going to put on my black hat. Why in God's green earth is the government messing around in my router? Secretly. Like, I could see if they sent me an email saying, hey, you have a problem. Would you like us to fix it? Then I have a choice. I can say, yes, I would like you to fix this problem. Please take care of it for me. Or, don't worry about it. I'll go change that password now. Because you can't just assume that people are dumb, okay? Maybe they were busy. Maybe they didn't understand, right? But for you to go in and muck around in my device secretly causes problems, man. Max, if you got an email from any government agency saying, hey, we just got into your router and reset all the passwords because you did a terrible job of picking passwords, you need to factory reset it and upgrade all your firmware, what would you do?
Well, you know, I think I would go pretty crazy immediately, very simply because I think that so as you say, there are two sides to the story, right? And you can understand that the perceived threat or reality of the threat kind of overrides, in that case, the individual rights of the rights of the individual. Obviously, there are two sides to the story, and I think that you wouldn't want any agency, be it, you know, the DOG or even worse, the IRS, to get into your stuff and start, you know, resetting passwords in your behalf and changing things, because it's clearly a breach of privacy and a breach of, you know, whatever is yours, right? I mean, if they're able to do that with the router, and if you can get to the router, then it means that you can get to what pretty much anything else inside the house and start resetting passwords and do whatever you want, right? So I think that it's really kind of a controversial move, in my view. Yeah, and it's one which I didn't follow, and I will need to check what the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, thinks about that approach. Now, that said, I think it was a pretty smart way of doing things and returning, you know, we'll say the carpet or something like that. But I would feel pretty much uncomfortable, and I would try to seek answers about, you know, why do you guys didn't try to plan it in a different way eventually.
So I'm going to go take the black hat off and put the white hat back on for a minute, because I agree with you that this is probably, like, I don't know if I feel 100% comfortable with that. That being said, it's not like they're breaking into your routers to figure out if you're paying your taxes or not. They're keeping a nation state actor out of your device. Because the other thing you got to remember is Fancy Bear doesn't do things like this because they're, you know, like the kids in the seminal 1995 work Hackers. This isn't Zero Cool or Crash Override. They're doing things for very specific reasons. And given the fact that it is an election year in the U.S., there's a lot of things that they could do if they had control of a few thousand devices that can amplify a lot of attacks. I'm not ascribing any motives to these folks. I'm not saying they had anything nefarious in mind. I'm just saying that if you have tools that are pre-staged that can do all kinds of stuff, who knows what you can get away with. So I'm glad that the Department of Justice has decided that this is something that needs to be dealt with. Again, I take issue with their methodology. Now, if there is a way for us to go into the federal government, say the CISA, and just say, from here on out, if we think your device has been compromised by Fancy Bear and we can prove it with a warrant or in a court of law, then we will go in and we will disable their access, which is what they did. Like, the court said you could go do this, which means you had to meet an evidentiary standard proving that it was accessed by foreign actors for a purpose that was, you know, illegal. And so, great. But you've got to keep people in the loop as you do it. And on the whole, if I got the email, I said, you know, everything had to be erased and reset, great. Like, once I confirmed it was from the actual DOJ and not someone pretending to be the DOJ, yeah, I'd probably breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief. But at the end of the day, I still need that process to be transparent. And I think that's where the biggest problem that I have right now is with the process, is that it is not transparent.
Yeah, the other thing which is interesting here as well is, you know, the responsibility of somehow, I don't know if it's really with the vendor or but probably with the vendors which kind of keep those default passwords all over the place. I mean, there's probably some effort going on to deliver devices which are more secured out of the box, but I think it calls into probably avoiding that too from happening again. And I mean, here we're talking about ubiquity routers, but let's think about all of the other, you know, IoT devices which are sold here and there and which can be also vectors for infection or misuse, right? So the question is, how do you kind of force the vendors to deliver solutions which are more secure out of the box? And perhaps also one of the things that we are alluding to is, how can you, let's say, cut off these devices without, you know, making an intrusion into them, right? So if there is a way you could, for example, if you're an ISP or something like that, you could detect, for example, that the password is by default and you could disable it from the network or send a message, whatever. And of course, I'm oversimplifying things because you know that I'm not a network guy. But I mean, there were probably other options to do it in a more elegant way, but at least it has the merits to fix the issue and open the debate.
Yeah, and this is something that's going to be an ongoing debate, because this is just the first wave of these kinds of things. And when you're dealing with it in cyberspace, it's not as cut and dried as, say, oh, I don't know, a criminal gang broke into my house and started, you know, running a smuggling ring out of it. Well, yeah, I want the police to come in and kick them out of my house, right? So it's a little bit different when it's in cyberspace, but hopefully we can come to a reasonable agreement about this in the future. And speaking of the future, we have some things coming up that I think everybody is going to want to know about. The first of them is actually happening, hold on, today, because this is AI Field Day. If you are interested in all things related to AI, including companies like Intel, Solidigm, VMware, Hammerspace, Qlik, and Vast Data, you should go check out techfieldday.com because my friend Stephen Foskett is going to be hosting great presentations from each of those companies. Make sure you check out the schedule on techfieldday.com. And while you're there, click on to the event next on the list, which is Networking Field Day. We have great presentations from Nile, Forward Networks, and Aviz Networks, which we mentioned today in the rundown. They'll be presenting for networking-focused delegates, and we'll be getting lots of great conversations about all the cool things that they're doing. And then April 10th and 11th is our Security Field Day. We're going to be talking about ransomware. We're going to be talking about firewalls. We're going to be talking about all things related to enterprise security, a lot of which affect some of the stories that we talked about here on the rundown. If you want to get a list of who's going to be involved in that, including delegates and companies, techfieldday.com is the place to check that out. Max, you're a very busy person when you're not helping me co-host the rundown. If people want to check out some of the things you're doing, where can they go to learn that?
You can follow me back again on X at Max Montilaro, and I'm still and always on LinkedIn, Max Montilaro as well, and of course our blog, techunplug.io/blog. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And remember that you can always tune in to the latest episode of The Rundown every Wednesday around 12:30 Eastern Time, if the encoding gods are kind to our laptops. You can also follow us on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/gestaltitvideo, on our website at gestaltit.com for show notes and links to the articles that we pulled in, as well as our audio podcast feed if you want to listen to the dulcet tones of our voices instead of just watching us on your favorite small screen device. We would love to hear from you. Leave us a rating, leave us a review so that people can understand that we're news with a little bit of a snarky slant to it. We'll be back next week with another great episode. It'll be Stephen Foskett and another co-host since I'll be at Networking Field Day. But until then, take care, stay safe, stay warm if you're still in a place that's cool, and we will see you then.